Welcome back to Pedagogy Non Grata, where we bridge the gap between scientific literature and teaching in the classroom. I'm joined here today by Dr. Zach, who is currently an ESL teacher. Is that correct?
No, I'm actually an instructional coach.
Instructional coach. Okay, so you're gonna have to explain more about that. And you just finished your PhD, correct?
Yeah, at like last week. So
Awesome. Fresh
off of this. Yeah,
that must feel amazing.
It does, but you know how you kind of wait till the end of the month when they confer it and send the degree and all that. It still looms over me, but yeah, it does feel good to have my life back.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations. Okay. Well, with that, a note, before I butcher your introduction any further, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah. So my name is Zach Groeschel. I blog at educationrickshaw.com on occasion, about maybe twice monthly. I'm an instructional coach, and I started in elementary teaching, and I taught elementary for 8 years. And I soon moved into coaching, into leadership. I currently work at an IB public school in Washington State, where I coach teachers, I deliver trainings. Here we have a lot of kids that are at risk and have a lot of trouble with behavior. So a lot of my job is really pitching in, getting hands on with ensuring we have behavior, school wide behavior expectations are being implemented. And I got a PhD in instructional design. I have a few other projects going on. I just released was a co-author in a book called Amplify Learning. Amplify Instructional Design was this volume. So, and I talk about assessment and feedback in that book. So yeah, that's me.
That's awesome. I also just wrote a book, and that's two of my favorite topics. So hopefully we can get into that a little bit. And I also saw on your blog, you're talking a lot about individualization and RTI, which are also favorite topics of mine. So before we go any further, why don't we talk about individualization, actually, because I think this is one of my all-time favorite topics, and you were discussing this recently on your blog. So I think you were kind of talking about some of the limitations with our current understanding of individualization. Do you want to sort of talk about how you think this can work or cannot work? What are the possible pros and cons, and what ways best can we individualize our instruction?
Right. Like, I think the principle of meeting one-on-one with a student is sound, right? Like, we've got all the way back Benjamin Bloom and the two sigma effect of working one-on-one with a student's got to work. It's sort of like that perfect educational setting for a student. If we could individualize to the point of every student getting exactly, the curated resources that they need right just in time, it would be marvelous. I think I really do focus a lot on the limitations of individual teaching or personalization, because I've just seen in some of the schools I've worked at where it's kind of run rampant, where I've worked at schools that sort of spoke a lot of the romantic or sort of progressive viewpoints and approaches to education. And the idea is that with a class of 30, with the same limitations we have in most schools, that you can personalize and you can individualize teaching and learning. And like, if I could just give a good example for the listeners of one school I worked at, where every Wednesday, the entire day was dedicated to personal interest projects. And it was at a school where a sizable chunk of the students couldn't read. Right. We were taking an entire day to work on bottle rockets or to sew things up. And, if you zoom out as a parent, maybe, and you're trying to apply for that school, it was like, tuition based school. Sounds awesome. My kid gets their needs met, their passion and their interests met. But when you looked in specifically at individual students and looked at the products that they were creating, they were childish. They were not sophisticated. There was a lot of time wasted. A lot of behaviors came out of that. And the opportunity cost there of losing the opportunity to read and learn English for these students and learn math was just terrible in my opinion. And so we can go in that direction. We can over individualize the curriculum. It's almost hyper fragmentation of the curriculum. And that really bothers me.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of the same things. I like that you kind of identify that there's this, you know, spectrum of teaching philosophies. I've talked about this a little. We sort of see this left-right paradigm apply to teaching. And I think people really entrench themselves into camps on those paradigms. Personally, I try to just look at it from a scientific perspective, what works and what doesn't. I find there's things on these far ends of each spectrum that seem really good, which is not something I feel about normally politically, although I won't talk about my personal political leanings on the show. But and I think it's the wrong paradigm. And I'm not accusing you of doing this, but I think it's the wrong paradigm to look at everything as like a camp. And I'm trying to just apply everything from this particular perspective. So, you know, you're talking about like individualization. I couldn't agree more, but it sounds like a waste of time to do special inquiry-based projects, for lack of a better word, or entirely inquiry-based learning for an entire day. Once a week, when you have students who can't read, I think you have to teach those students how to read first.
I think if I could kind of build off what you said about the sort of the camps, you know, I actually recently, because people either like or dislike this dichotomy, that's, you know, traditional education on one side and progressive education on the other, where traditional education is really, we have a teacher leading the learning and bringing the subject to the student. Where in the progressive side, we sort of have the belief that students can self-teach or can pursue their own passions and find subjects on their own. I kind of did a little bit of a parody on it, sort of a parody with one of my friends, where we did a podcast on it called Progressively Incorrect. And I think what we found was, between us, me maybe more falling in the traditional side, that there were a lot of areas that we had in common, but also real differences in what we believe in terms of teaching. But you know, the belief, for example, that certain minimum requirements need to be taught and probably should be taught explicitly, that was maybe never agreed upon by the end of the podcast project.
Oh, wow. Yeah. See, that's how I view it. So I will say, like, we're at the end of the school year here, and in my personal classroom, I use an RTI model. So I map the curriculum out for the year, and I make sure that all my students achieve certain curriculum targets. And as soon as the student achieves the curriculum targets, we switch to entirely inquiry-based learning for that student, and they get a lot more say over their learning, but it's still guided and directed towards goals. But like, if a student hasn't mastered the curriculum that I'm teaching to them, they don't get that opportunity. And usually most of the class within the last like 3-4 weeks ends up at that point, but you end up having usually one or two kids who don't really get the curriculum done to like the last 2 days of school. And you might have one student who's working at an enriched level like 5 weeks ahead of time. But I think that's, I like that, because it's one, it's motivating to students, and two, you're not missing anything behind. But,
and I think maybe that, going back to the question, like, what do I think about individualized teaching and where do I see it fit? I think that I like to talk about cognitive load theory, and they have a piece, an effect called the expertise reversal effect. And that's where I see it happening. I think that a lot of that upfront expository teaching happens at the beginning. Yeah. And you slowly sort of fade the scaffolds and you fade the supports. And you finally come to the end where that student's now considered a relative expert in that particular domain. And that's where they're now kind of inquiring, applying, they're doing things that you probably can't really predict what will happen, because they're kind of taken off. So, you know, I don't think that, I personally have come to the conclusion that that's not really a middle ground, that's just really good direct instruction ending in application. But some people will call that, I started with traditional teaching and I ended with progressive teaching, and they consider themselves in sort of the middle. And we've even talked, I think, and elsewhere, about middle ground being sort of a fallacy. So anyway, lots of interesting things there, but that's kind of where I see, you know, this discussion, you know, relating to that.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said, to be honest. Now, are there any, it's funny, I think when we talk about individualization, sometimes people mean different things. So I think I've seen you're clearly talking about student-centered teaching, and you know, I often see like things like floated towards teaching to learning styles, which I saw you critique a little. I'm personally quite critical of teaching to learning styles. But I think there are areas where it makes more sense. Are there any areas of teaching to individual student needs where you think it makes more sense?
Where it makes more sense? I mean, I think you've blogged about RTI, and you've actually trained in RTI, where RTI was maybe a course or two in my teacher training, and then how schools have implemented it, I think, was just a bit how the teacher interpreted it, how the training team interpreted it. Here we're supposed to have it, and how that really manifests itself is varies, you know, considerably. But I think RTI is sort of the answer. We have assessments that tell us, you know, that allow us to decide when the whole group is going to get sort of some instruction on a particular area. And we're flexible with the groupings where we start to move up into tiered instruction and tier two and tier three. And it's that tier two and three where we're really individualizing, we're creating small groups. That model to me makes more sense than, like you just said, creating kind of imaginary groupings, categories of students by learning style, or even worse, which is, you know, this has come up in sort of the UDL world, which is we don't really need to name the learning style. Just everyone has such a unique style of learning that we don't need to categorize it, but they know how they learn best. Mm-hmm. And I think that's almost even more damaging, because it's almost like there's no argument against it. It's just everyone is so different from each other that let them lead the learning. And I think we have to start with that expertise to, you know, novice to expert continuum, and we have to lead the learning at the beginning.
Yeah, it's really challenging to deal with people who float very undefined idealist narratives, because it's hard to address something that's not well defined, but that's also super idealist at the same time. I agree with you that RTI is probably at least part of the answer. Personally, I'll just say I individualize curriculum in the sense that but using an RTI framework where, you know, I use assessments to track student learning, and I make sure that I cover all the curriculum. But if a student is behind, I make sure I give them extra instruction. And if a student is ahead, I provide them with enrichment, which I'm very partial to that model. But I think I will admit the con of that is it's a ton of work. And I don't know if that can ever be fully implemented on a system level. I don't know about you. I found some difficulties. I love the RTI model, but I've also found some difficulties with it. Have you found any difficulties with the RTI model?
Well, we call it here, because we, you know, our scores are in the single or just early double digits, right? We're talking about 16% proficiency in some of the subjects, right? So that pyramid, we call it like an inverted pyramid, right? We have a situation where what we need is whole class interventions. We need to think about really giving remediation to most students. And that's where I think it can be really tricky. If you have this beautiful sort of mixture of students who are on target and are ahead, and a few that are below, then it seems like you can flex around that. And it seems like you can brainstorm and problem solve around that. We have a real issue of trying to teach grade level content to students who are years and years behind. And there are very few students who necessitate our attention when it comes to extension.
That's interesting. I thought maybe you were kind of alluding to this. I have found that the implementation of RTI is tricky, because it is a complex framework. It's not like an easy, straightforward framework. And I have found that it is often implemented poorly. And I don't know if that's a problem with the training, because I know there are like professional RTI trainers, or if that's just because, you know, teacher training in general is a very difficult thing to do, or if it's because when people are confronted with a complex thing, they just try to take it and make it their own anyways and completely change it. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, it includes formative assessment and includes analyzing data. And those are two things that are on their own. They're components of RTI, but they're hard to do on their own. I mean, you know, you've seen it where formative assessment didn't have the second part, which is the responsive part, right? There was no responding, there was only assessing, or the assessment itself wasn't rigorous enough to be able to trust it. And sort of the response came out of not actually out of an assessment. And then with data, how it can be interpreted the way the user wants it to be interpreted. So the assessment was almost pointless to have given in the first place. All of these are part of RTI, and It's like you really have, we have to be a profession that thinks about teaching and learning like we're scientists, like we're detectives almost. And those are two professions that are really highly regarded in society, and they require really, you know, people that are really on top of it.
Yeah. I've never really talked about this before. I don't think, but I'd like to see teaching move more in towards the way medicine operates, in the sense that there are recommended procedures and practices for recommended problems. Like, your student is struggling with this difficulty, this is what we'll do. And I just think that doctors tend to treat these things a little more scientifically than we do. We tend to think of teaching as an art, and there is obviously an art to teaching for sure, but I think there's more science in it than we care to admit. I will also say that, you know, we see in the research, like the studies on just formative assessment, all the studies where they just look at formative assessment and nothing else, they all show really low results, like consistently, like it's crazy. And yet we look at RTI research, and as much as I think there could be problems with some of the RTI implementation, it generally speaking shows really high results in the research. And I think it's that response to that formative assessment that's really changing things up. If you just assess a kid and you don't make any changes off of it, that assessment was useless. But
and you know, teachers are busy, so if there's several steps, we can count on the earliest step, and then the last step is the one that's furthest from, you know, probably actually being implemented. And it is the respond part, and how do I respond? And, you know, going back to hyper individualization, sometimes the response is not to get the class together and to reteach. Sometimes the response is, I'm going to work with this one student every day for this amount of days. But what is everyone else doing, right? I see a lot of times the whole class gets segmented, gets splintered to the point where teachers are working with individuals and neglecting the other 29 students. So, you know, maybe that's where a lot of the low outcomes for formative assessment might be found. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I don't know for sure either. People always ask me the why behind these questions, and the why is way harder to answer. And as soon as you're answering a why question, it's almost always that you're giving your subjective opinion. It's really hard to answer that based off like scientific research, because the scientist doesn't usually address the why, it usually addresses the what. But sorry. So one of the things you have talked a lot about is feedback. So are there particular strategies that you advocate for with your students when you're talking about feedback?
Well, yeah, I mean, so feedback has a long history of research. And I think it really came on the scene with John Hattie's work. But we look at the studies specifically, and this is where kind of I've learned from educationalist Dylan William, where you look at specific meta-analyses or specific studies within those meta-analyses, and you find there could even be negative effects of feedback, undesired effects of feedback. So the thing about feedback, I think how it's important to think about it in a way that is productive. And feedback generally has to make the student or prompt the student, compel the student to go do something, to make a change in what they're doing. And a lot of times our feedback is really directed at their product. A good example is when a student is writing an essay and the teacher is giving lots of marking ups on the essay. Student looks at the marks, doesn't really know why those were made or why those were given, but they create a second draft that is objectively better than the first one, and they actually didn't themselves change at all, but the essay did. So I think a lot of times we have to get teachers thinking about changing the learner, and that sometimes isn't really necessarily only about giving marks on a paper. It's really about having a conversation with them, and it might also involve a lot of reteaching and instruction. That's really one area that I kind of like to focus on. The second one, if you'll indulge me.
No, go for it.
Really about feedback, I think is there does exist a continuum of sort of high information to low information feedback. And I sometimes see that the feedback given is really at that low end of sort of minimal information or sort of corrective information. It's only like yes, no type of feedback. And we get this a lot of times in technology where you just get an X or a check saying you did it or you didn't do it. Teachers going around and say, that's wrong, that's right. I do encourage teachers to kind of think about their feedback in ways that we're not overloading them with information, but we are having a discussion, a dialogic interaction around the why behind it, or the how behind what's going on with their product. I think that if we look at that, so, you know, there's a paper that talks of epistemic feedback or triple loop feedback. If we look at ways of sort of getting into a dialogue with students around their feedback and getting them to actually use it and move themselves forward, I think we're going to see higher effects than low information feedback that is really directed at the product rather than the student. So yeah, those are my two things I've been thinking about.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything you just said. I do struggle a little with feedback myself in the sense that it's so laborious. Like to especially if you're going to write the feedback, I personally try to get around it by doing a lot of like conferencing with students, a lot of like one-on-one conversations about their work. And really, I also try to make sure that the marking scheme is really abundantly clear before they do their work. So that the idea being hopefully that they sort of choose their mark and do the work, the requirements they need to get the mark they want, which I'm sure is probably controversial to some, but, yeah. One thing I've seen come up a lot with feedback is the importance of immediacy. Have you looked at that at all or thought about it much?
I have. And this is funny because it's sort of like immediate feedback makes sense on so many levels, but we also have this spacing effect, right? And so I think it was a Learning Scientist podcast, but a few papers about this where, like, if we think of feedback as just an additional presentation of information, then wouldn't we want it to be masked at first and then to be spaced out? And so if feedback is given immediately and then never again, it might almost be better sometimes to give a slight delay in order to bring it closer to the assessment that they're going to take on that particular goal. And so the immediate versus spaced out or delayed piece is, it's really hard for me to wrap my head around. I don't know what you've read on this topic.
I have no firm opinion just because I have not found enough research on it. I've looked several times and I've seen like really strong claims made by some people. Like if you're doing it this way, you're doing it wrong. But I've only seen like, as you point out, a handful of experimental papers. To best my knowledge, there's no peer-reviewed meta-analysis on the topic. And I try to either rely on a peer-reviewed meta-analysis or my own, and I haven't done my own. So I don't feel comfortable commenting. I think it makes sense to me, immediate feedback, as you point out. I think there's something intuitively logical about it. I think there's just probably a sense of that it's already in the kid's mind. They've just been thinking about, they've just done it. So maybe it could be helpful. But I think you do raise a good point. Like if you're going to be assessing them on again, which is really hopefully the point of feedback so that they can improve for next time, it does make sense to give them that feedback a little closer to the next assessment. I would say maybe even do both. But again, I think the thing about feedback that's so difficult is it's so laborious, especially if it's written. Like the idea of like writing, like I know some teachers will like write a paragraph on like every piece of work that every student does and they mark everything. And I feel like they're great teachers. Those are superheroes. But I don't have the energy to give a paragraph on every single thing my students hand me in. But
and I think the solution to this, and if you're listening to this and you've found yourself marking notebooks, you know, all night long, and you're not even sure if this time is, you know, worthwhile. You could be doing other things. You could be planning. I think the solution to this might be the whole class feedback sort of movement that has come about, where instead of marking 29 books, you strategically sample. So basically you take, you know, that there's some lows, some mediums and some highs in your class. You pick two of each and now you've got six notebooks. You take some notes on what you see on those. You use a little bit of your subject matter expertise around kind of what are some things that generally I tell students about. And you create a whole class feedback lesson where really, hey, I saw these things in my strategic sampling last night. I'm going to go put this, you know, in your learning management system. I'm going to print it out and give you a handout about it. And I'd like you to take this feedback. I'd like you to apply it to your work. And you lose the individualization that we talked about, but what you gain is efficiency. And so there is a paper by Keim and colleagues about, you know, whole class feedback. It reduces workload because teachers aren't doing all these marks, and it could have the same or similar benefits to individualized marking. So, I mean, that is one solution I suggest to my teachers if they're finding that we just don't want teachers to never give feedback. So wouldn't it be better to have a whole class feedback lesson than to skip feedback because it's so laborious?
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm all about trying to find more efficient ways to teach. So I think that's actually an excellent piece of advice for everyone. So that brings me to my final question. And that is, if you could change one thing about the education industry, what would you change? And I actually think that's a really hard question. I thought about it myself. I've never actually asked anyone this. I don't know why. I'm just putting you on the spot. I think it's because most people I have on, they're like very like specifically into one area of study. And you seem very generalist, which I must admit, I'm a bit of a generalist myself. So what is the one change you would like to see?
Well, I mean, there are some amazing educators in this world that are highly engaged. And we see this on social media. You see this in every school, right? Unfortunately, in my experience, I've now worked in 12 years because of COVID and life changes. I've worked in 6 different schools. And across all of those schools, I've just noticed that there's just not as much of an emphasis on teaching and learning as there really should be, or at least that what everyone probably thinks teaching is the profession of teaching is about. I think before I became a teacher, I pictured teachers sitting around in circles and discussing their techniques and modeling their techniques, observing each other through lesson studies and reading books about teaching. My mom's a teacher, but she teaches preschool. And I guess I thought maybe when you got up to the older grades, it started to become this intellectual technique. And so if I had to change anything, it would really be that teachers become engaged with the science of learning, that they view this teaching as, like you said, both an art and a science, and that's what our main topic of discussion is in schools. We get so tied down in schools about talking about logistics, about sort of the union versus the admin and the politics of education. And sometimes we even resort to just talking about individual students and how much they bugged us that day. And I really wish, and I really want to see education move to a place where we're talking about teaching, we're talking about ways to address gaps in learning, and that we're not letting kids fall through the cracks because of that effort.
I really liked your answer. I think it is a tough thing to keep your love of teaching over a long career, but I think it's important. And I think any way you can do that is helpful. I actually think engaging with these types of scientific discussions around it can be motivating, because when you hear other people talk about their ideas, they can give you ideas. And just that sharing of knowledge, I think, can help re-excite the teaching environment. But I really want to thank you for your time and coming on the podcast. It's been a real treat having you on. Where can our audience find more about you?
Yeah, go to my blog. It's educationrickshaw.com. Check out the book that I was featured in called Amplifying Instructional Design on Amazon. And feel free to reach out. I'm always doing projects, podcasts, and I'm interested in getting to know you and learning about your context. So yeah, but my name is Zach Groeschel, and I do appreciate the chance to be on the show.
Thanks again, Zach.